Arizona News Radio, 20% containment on the Wallow Fire as new Trioso residents go back home. Still concerns about some other unburned areas as well.
There's probably 700 or 800 firefighters operating in just this area. So that one fire, that one area in and of itself is as complex as a lot of regular type 1 incidents.
The Monument Fire near Sierra Vista, 5,200 acres, 10% contained, and they don't want to see a flare-up like yesterday.
The winds are predicted to be at 25 miles an hour. The conditions are very, very dry.
A lot of blame shifted at a House hearing on a federal firearms bust that allowed weapons to get into the hands of Mexican drug cartels.
When I voiced surprise and concern with this tactic, my concerns were dismissed.
One of those weapons used in a shootout that killed Agent Brian Terry. And lawyers discussing jury instructions, closing arguments in the Camp Verde trial of motivational speaker James Ray.
There may be speech here, and you just can't use that as a reason to be prejudiced or biased.
George Taylor, Arizona News.
And this KFNX Traffic Report is brought to you by your Arizona Farmers Insurance agents. Westbound on the 10 right before 7th Street, you're going to find a collision there. Also westbound on the 10 at 16th Street, there's a fender bender. You're also going to find some slow traffic on the Maricopa, eastbound between 32nd Street and the Superstition. Are you saving as much as you could? See how your knowledgeable local farmers agent can save you money. Call Curtis Johnson at 928-474-5201 today. We are insurance. We are farmers.
Jim Howell for the KFNX Weather Center. Believe it or not, we're going to have a gradual cool down into the weekend. We'll still remain above the century mark by Friday, 103. And into our weekend, Sunday afternoon, we're back to 100. Jim Howell, KFNX News Talk Radio, 1100.
And currently at our downtown studios, we're sitting at 107 degrees. Next news in 30 minutes. And when it breaks here on KFNX News Talk Radio, 1100.
Could switching to Geico really save you 15% or more on car insurance? Is trying to sneak out of a really boring meeting wearing tap shoes a bad idea?
Sales growth has increased 2.9%. That's a reflection of aggressive. Then where are you going?
Nowhere. Headed back to my seat now.
Switch to Geico now and you could save hundreds on your car insurance. For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
Could switching to Geico really save you 15% or more on car insurance? Do only dogs hear dog whistles?
You could enjoy multi-car safety feature and good driver discounts when you switch to Geico. For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
This is Legalese, where the law is always on your side. Now introducing your host, a longtime veteran of the courts, Dennis Willinchek.
This is Dennis Willinchek, and it's Wednesday, 4:05 or 4:06, and we're here on Legalese every week, leading into the Lou Dobbs Show at 5 o'clock. And we talk about legal issues on the show, and if you want to call up, our number is 602-277-KFNX. And today we're going to be talking with Judge Ann Timmer, who is on the Arizona Court of Appeals, just recently served as chief judge for 2 years of the Court of Appeals. And we're going to be talking about issues relating to the Court of Appeals as well as other issues. And one of the hot topics, Judge Timmer was or is chairman of a commission or committee to look into the probate system. There's been a lot of controversy about that we're going to be talking about. But first, welcome to the show, Judge Timmer.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you. And let's talk a little bit about your background. Obviously, I know some of your background because I have a strong recollection of being the one that hired you out of law school. So certainly I know your background, but many of our listeners don't know that. So tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, my background is I actually wasn't born in Arizona, but I consider Arizona my native home. So I've been here since I was in high school, went to Arcadia High School locally here, stayed, loved Arizona, so didn't want to go anywhere away from college. So I went to University of Arizona for undergrad and then Arizona State for my law degree.
Right.
And was hired out of school by you and your firm.
Right.
At the time and worked with you.
You did a great job, too.
Thank you.
And just so I know you don't want to sing your own praises, but I looked this up on the internet. You received your Juris Doctor from ASU, as you said. You graduated magna cum laude. And while attending ASU, and this part I do remember, actually, you were editor for the Arizona State Law Journal, a member of the National Appellate Advocacy Team, and received the American College of Trial Lawyers Medal for Excellence in Advocacy. And my recollection is you were, like, in New York arguing on the moot court team. Is that right?
I was. We were fortunate enough to be the regional winners here and went on to New York, which was my first time in New York. So I think most of my memories of that were simply seeing the big city and should have practiced more because I think we went down miserably in the competition, but that wasn't the point. The point was getting there.
Yeah, I've had that experience. But, you know, that is actually interesting. The appellate advocacy classes in law school, based on your experience now, having been chief judge of the Court of Appeals, do you think that it fairly resembles what lawyers deal with actually in the Court of Appeals? Is it a good educational harbinger or precursor for being in the Court of Appeals, arguing?
It is. It will give you the best experience you can have in law school, certainly, is to be on your feet, being questioned by not professors, but you bring in real judges, real lawyers in the community who can ask anything off the wall, unanticipated,
yeah.
And so you can't substitute that experience. The difference is that, and I find this a lot with my law clerks who come, who are just recent graduates from law school, that they sit in court and watch real lawyers, and they very often will be unimpressed because someone's not as polished, that kind of thing, and they don't realize that when you're in a class, you've practiced over and over and over, and you've had lots of...
You have one case.
Right, and that's it. Right, where lawyers, you know, they work day to day, and they have to keep an eye on the clock, and so maybe they're not as polished, but it's still the best experience you can have.
Yeah, no, I was saying to you off the air that I happened to yesterday have a wonderful experience helping prepare our attorney general for an argument and bank in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and basically we conducted it as if we were the judges in a moot court. And which I might add, I was very impressed with his ability to prepare. But I had the same thought as I left with an associate. I said, you know, it would be wonderful if you had one case and all you had to do was have all the time in the world to work on that case and you knew you were going to get paid for it. But that's not the reality of the world.
No.
So a lot of times you see lawyers up in the Court of Appeals and I'm sure they're not 100% prepared, right? It must be frustrating to some extent.
Sometimes, but I think most everyone realizes that, come on, the client can't afford to pay for maybe 20 hours worth of preparation, for example.
Yeah.
So kind of very forgiving, and as long as you're able to adequately communicate your position so that you're able to be persuasive, that's what we're really looking for.
Yeah. Well, that's helpful. In fact, I have another question along those same lines while we're on it. One of the things that it took me over 30 years to learn in this profession was simply to say, I don't know, to a question, because it's hard to do that. Everybody expects you to know everything. But do you agree that when you're even at the Court of Appeals and you don't know something, it's far better to say, I just don't know, I'll check into that or I'll supplement or something? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. The worst thing a lawyer can do is just give a good guess and as if it was a true fact, because I guarantee you, at least at the Court of Appeals, we have law clerks, we have the judges, we do scour the record and the briefs and the cases with a fine-tooth comb, because for the most part, your case is going to stop at our court. Very few go on to the Supreme Court. So we know since it's the last stop, we're going to scour that. And so if you've given an answer that's wrong, you've hurt your credibility not only in that case, but probably in future cases. So I think it's always best to simply say, you know what, Your Honor, I don't know. If you'd like me to look into it and give you something further, great. Usually we'll say no because we can look it up ourselves, but we appreciate candor.
Yeah. I take it that leaving private practice and going on the bench for you was a dream, I'm sure, right?
It was. Mm-hmm.
And having, again, known you as a great writer, let's talk about your family are all writers, right?
In some way or the other, they are.
Yeah.
Yes, I have two brothers who are both attorneys, one in litigation in California and one does real estate law in Florida. My father was...
Where in Florida?
Tampa, St. Pete, that area. And my mother was an English major and a teacher, and my father, journalist for his entire life, and my sister is a columnist at the Arizona Republic.
Yeah. Why didn't you go into journalism? I'm just curious.
I never even considered it. I think at the time that I thought of, I decided when I was in high school I really wanted to go to law school, and it was probably because my older brother was in law school, and the whole concept of the importance of the judiciary and the law and lawyers really captured my attention when studying American history, and I thought that's what I want to do.
Yeah. Well, being on the Court of Appeals, for many of our listeners who don't understand how the system works, we should probably describe. The Court of Appeals listens to appeals from matters from generally the Superior Court of the state of Arizona. There may be exceptions to that, but generally that's where you'll hear them from. And basically you have three judge panels, right?
Right.
And you issue opinions primarily on legal issues. Is that fair?
Well, not always.
Yeah.
If you want to look at it, there's two appellate courts. There's the Intermediate Court of Appeals, which I sit on, and then there's the Supreme Court. And a lot of people in there ask, well, what's the difference?
Yeah.
The real difference that's very accurate that I've heard described over and over is that the Court of Appeals is the error-correcting court. So if there's been a mistake of law, it often involves law, obviously, but it can be mistakes of fact as well. So we correct errors, and with exception, we don't have a choice about what cases we take. We just take them all. The Supreme Court is really more of these setting. They're not there to correct errors in any particular case as much as to resolve conflicts that have statewide interest, resolve conflicts between the two divisions of the Court of Appeals, and give guidance to the whole state. That's why they take very, very, very few cases.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I was always led to believe that the lower court resolves factual issues. The appellate court generally doesn't get too much into the facts of the case. They're not there to decide the facts of the case.
Well, that's true. I mean, the court of obviously we don't have a jury. We don't have witnesses. We have the record is established at the trial court. What I mean is, we still though look to see, for example, was the burden of proof met in a criminal case, for example? Were sufficient facts there to support the conviction?
See. Yes.
So you have it's mostly application of law to facts.
Let's talk for a minute about more of your background before we take our break. You were involved in the impeachment of Evan Meekum. Now, a lot of people listening may not even remember Evan Meekum.
I wasn't born then.
You what?
They probably weren't born then.
We've got 2 minutes before our break. Tell us about that experience.
Well, gosh, that was back in 1988,
right.
And I was a young attorney, youngish at that time, in my first firm with you, actually, Storian Ross, and Bill French was the head investigator, lead prosecutor, whatever the term that they called him, and he asked if I and a number of others would help him out on the case, not only in the impeachment part of the House, but then the impeachment trial at the Senate. That was a fabulous experience because it was all brand new, and really there were no set procedures out there to follow. So we had to, I don't want to say make them up, but some of them fill in the holes by just proceeding as we thought was appropriate in this very narrow and very unique area of law. But it was a real thrill, and Bill was very generous and let me argue a couple times on the Senate floor, on TV. It was a very peculiar scenario, and to have all of the senators were the jurors, but they also got to question you, was a unique experience as well. So,
yeah, it's a little bit of law and theater, I guess.
It really was. I know they went into, of course, they're in politics and to make statements, so it's not your average question. A lot of times they would be statements and then a question.
All right, we're going to come back to that and other topics with Judge Ann Timmer from the Court of Appeals. This is Dennis Wolinchek on Legalese, and we'll be back after these brief messages.
Since 1991, the law offices of Wolinchek & Bartness have provided quality business litigation service that you'd find at a big firm with small firm atmosphere. Wolinchek & Bartness specialize in cases of breach of contract, real estate litigation, construction defect, business fraud, and breach of fiduciary duty. For professional yet very personal legal representation, call Wolinchek & Bartness today at 602-606-2810, 602-606-2810.
Hello, my name is Craig Roddle. I am a wealth strategist with CSP Financial Group. I invite you to listen to Heroes Talk Radio every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. where you will learn to plan for a tax-free retirement. At CSP Financial Group, we are experts in maximizing your current assets and growing your retirement accounts. At CSP Financial Group, our experience can help you generate a lifetime income stream. You can visit our website at cspfg.com and listen to Heroes Talk Radio, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on KFNX News Talk Radio 1100.
Take part in the national conversation. Tune in to The Lou Dobbs Show. weekdays at 5 p.m. only on KFNX News Talk Radio 1100 and streaming live at 1100KFNX.com.
Arizona sports fans, this is Andy Dorf, host of Dorf on Sports, heard every Wednesday from 9 to 10 p.m. on KFNX Radio for my good friends, azcasino.com. Get dialed in with the online leader since 1997, that's GoTo Entertainment's azcasino.com. Call 888-333-PLAY now and mention Dorf on Sports for a $25 free play, a 25% cash bonus, that's 888-333-PLAY, that's GoTo Entertainment's azcasino.com. Any wager, any sport, anytime, azcasino.com.
Join Brian Hageman, inventor of the natural energy engine, every Tuesday at noon for the Deluge Energy Report. Expert guests from business, government, and science discuss everything from energy policy to the price at the pump. Deluge Energy Report, Tuesday at noon.
This is Dennis Mulacek. We're here on Legalese, and we're here with Judge Ann Timmer from the Court of Appeals talking about issues relating to the Court of Appeals, which many of our listeners probably aren't that familiar with. Judge Timmer, you just stepped down as chief judge. What is the chief judge of the Court of Appeals, and what does the chief judge do?
Well, not quite stepped down. I have two more weeks.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to rush you.
Two more weeks. By statute, there is one person who is designated for the chief judge who has all the administrative authority over the court, and that person is supposed to serve in one-year terms. I actually ended up serving 3 years because a lot was going on.
Well, it's kind of unusual. I don't think there were a lot of judges that have done that, have there?
One that I can think of, and that Shelley Weisberg, two chiefs ago, did 3 years. Usually, traditionally on Division I, we'll do 2 year stints.
Okay.
So 1 year renewal.
Didn't realize
that. We have Division II, and I don't know if your listeners probably don't realize, but we do. There's one Court of Appeals in our state, but we divide it into two divisions. So Division I, which is the largest, are comprised of 16 judges, and we take anything coming out of Maricopa County and six other counties. So we have seven other counties. We have eight counties, and then Division II out of Tucson, six judges, seven counties.
Right.
So Division II, since they're smaller, they do 5 year stints. But the chief will do things like, anything from chief bottle washer, it seems like, of resolving kind of personnel conflicts, presiding over any kind of budget. The budget's the big thing, especially during my term, the budget was a big issue, obviously. So dealing with going out to deal with the legislature and telling them what the needs of the court are and why, we can handle certain cuts, but other ones will be more difficult, and how it will impact making cuts at the court. And we've had courts cuts, obviously, in the last 3 years. So a lot of what then I've done is...
Yeah, I was going to ask you, if I can interrupt, how does that affect the court, given the economy right now?
Well, like everybody else, it makes you just slows down your productivity. Budget cuts do what you hear a lot of people saying. Some of it can be good because what it does is it forces you to reexamine your procedures and then decide, do we really need to do it this way? Is there a more efficient way we can do it with fewer people? And so it is an opportunity to force you into looking at your procedures.
What's the biggest thing the court has done to cut its expenses?
Well, we had to, unfortunately, we furloughed this year, and we had to have some layoffs this year. And we were able to find jobs, though, elsewhere in the judiciary two or three people that we had to lay off. And I was gratified to do that. One we could not.
And what kinds of capacities? Not staff attorneys or anything?
No, it was
staff
attorney that we couldn't find a place for, and we just couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, most of our budget are people. Their salaries. We don't have funded programs. We have programs, but they're not funded. We don't have anything except people who do the job that are directly connected with the job. So when you have cuts to our court, unlike some of the others who might have, we'll just stop a particular nice program that we've been devoting funds to. We don't have that. We're also the only court.
Well, you have to take appeals. You can't turn them down, right?
No, we can't. With the exception, we have to take them.
Yeah.
So what we
Excuse me for interrupting again, but what is the volume of these appeals and how, in terms of the last couple of years, has it gone up?
It has gone up in Division I. I don't have the stats with me, but we had about 2,800 cases that come in for 16 judges to handle.
Right.
Obviously, we have other staff to help out, staff attorneys and
right.
such, but it's quite a volume. And
you don't have to give oral argument to each of these cases.
No. In fact, very few ask for it everyone will look and decide, do we really need oral argument? Will it add anything to what we wrote down?
Right, and given the number of cases and the cutbacks and so forth, it seemed to me that you probably can't possibly consider giving argument in every case.
No, you know what? We still haven't had to cut back too much. When people ask for it, it's the chief judge that decides if oral argument requests should be granted or not. And I'll look at them. And every chief judge has their own view of it. My personal view is that, particularly in civil cases, or if the lawyers ask for it, if they want it, then I figure they know their case, they know what their client can afford to pay, and I generally will grant it unless it's just really a case that there's going to be no help. I might look more.
How do you determine that with all those cases? How do you know?
Well, one by one, just read their. To make a request, you have to say why you want it.
So you go through all of that?
I do.
Wow.
Yeah, I do. Well, a staff attorney will gather them and then make recommendations, and then I go through the stack and either grant them or deny them.
Seems like a lot of work. Now I'm going to ask you a question that I know is near and dear to your heart, off that topic. Why does Division II give opinions in advance of the hearings? And Division One doesn't.
That is near and dear to my heart.
I knew you'd enjoy that question.
Oh my! And it's interesting. Just for your listeners, to describe the process.
Yeah.
Division Two will, if you have an oral argument, they will actually send out to the lawyers, as you know, a proposed written disposition of the case. So it's all like a preview that at least one judge thinks that your case on appeal should be either affirmed, reversed, or a combination. So the parties know that when they come to the argument, and the theory is, and the practice is, they can argue off of that and try to either, one side will say, yes, we like that, or the other side says, no, let me tell you why that's wrong.
Or get incredibly depressed and not show up at all.
Exactly, or just settle quickly.
Right.
And it does hone the argument. Now, of course, the risk is that you have to remember as the litigants that, well, wait a minute, just because one judge feels this way, the other two might not, so you don't feel too confident because you don't know.
And those judges don't caucus or meet about the case prior to that opinion, so you really don't know,
no,
right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Although, you know, there's nothing that prevents them from kind of informally chatting or anything like that, but no, they don't.
So you can't get too depressed when you get that.
Well, that's right. You can, and you'd rather know, probably. And that's what most lawyers I know actually like that procedure, because they say, well, we'd rather know than not know. Division One doesn't do it that way. You don't know what we're thinking until we actually have the argument and issue the decision. Here's the reason. And last year, as a matter of fact, one of my prerogatives of chief judge, I asked that Division Two had an opening when one of their members was sent up to the Supreme Court, so they needed help. So I volunteered to go down and sit in his place until they appointed a new judge. Part of the reason is I wanted to help out my colleagues down there, but a more selfish reason is that I wanted to see, how does this practice really work, and what do they do? And so I wrote a decision that then was issued to the parties. I didn't have any discussions with the other two.
Right.
So it made me nervous, because maybe they think that I'm dead wrong and I'm going to be embarrassed by it. But they didn't. Actually, they ended up agreeing. And I was surprised the parties didn't really ask too much off of the proposed decision. So it was rather odd. But I realized that the way that we operate up here, we can't do what Division II does unless we dramatically change the way of operating.
Is it because of the volume?
Partially the volume, but more of the scheduling. What they do is, see, that because there's only six, they sit in two three-person panels, and they stay there. They don't switch up. We sit in 5 3-person panels, and we do switch up every 4 months. And the theory being, you don't want to get too comfortable with your set, and you have different ideas and different experience and background that will assist in making a decision. So we change up. But the way they do their assignments down there is, when something is filed, the clerk of the court will just assign it to one particular judge, and to Judge 1, Judge 2, Judge 3, and so on. And they will put their cases on the calendar once that judge has finished a proposed decision.
Right.
So their calendars are driven by their decision. In Division One, they'll just be set, and we might only get 2 weeks notice before something comes up. So we don't have the 2 weeks to a month notice before a case comes up on your calendar. So we don't have that kind of notice and time and ability to actually write a decision and issue it in all cases. So
Let's just explore that for another minute. Mm-hmm. So how does a typical appeal work? Tell us the process. In other words, it's fascinating to me. I'm sure we have a lot of lawyers listening. How does that process work? You get assigned, you say, this case, and the panel is picked. Mm-hmm. Is it just a random selection of who the panel is going to be, or are they sit in panels?
The chief judge is the one in Division One who decides who sits in what panels for what period of time. I used an Excel spreadsheet that kind of just randomly assigned folks, so that with the parameters, one of the parameters being put people together who haven't served together before as much as possible. So you can vary up the experience for people. Then once those are set, it's almost like school semesters. You might have September through December as our fall panels, for example. The clerk of the court was the one who sets the calendars, and she will distribute cases evenly. So someone might have a civil calendar one week, criminal the next, workers'
comp. So it's just done randomly, basically.
It's done randomly. So the judges have no ability to pick what they're going to hear, which is important. So then when things are assigned to a panel, one judge on that panel is designated the presiding judge, and that judge will then decide who is going to be assigned what case to ultimately author.
And so after that's done, and we have probably about a minute before the break, so we may have to pick this up after. But after that's done and the argument is set, mm-hmm. are you saying in the opinion, they really haven't discussed it much other than just right before the argument?
Correct. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you might, particularly in very, very, very close cases, you might have a couple emails go back and forth or hallway discussions or,
Yeah. But generally you don't have the opinion written before the argument?
No, normally we do. Normally if it's assigned to a chambers, we'll have it a proposed disposition, but it's only circulated to the other two judges.
Okay. So the lawyers don't know that, but the judges have a feeling where they're going to go before the argument.
At least the one judge does, but they change. And that's another reason that we don't want to send them out.
So I guess the bottom line is argument can potentially change the opinion of judges because they haven't written the opinion at that point.
Yes, even if you have a written disposition,
good.
It can change.
That's good to know. Okay, we'll be back after these messages. This is Dennis Wolinchek on Legalese with Judge Ann Timmer of the Court of Appeals at KFNX. And talk to you in a few minutes.
I'm Steve Malzberg. Listen to me from 1 to 3 every weekday afternoon on the 50,000-watt Voice of the Valley, KFNX, News Talk Radio 1100, Phoenix.
CNN Radio, I'm Andrew Spencer. Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords has been discharged from the hospital after 5 months of rehab following a shooting that killed 6 people in Arizona. Ms. Giffords now starts outpatient treatment. A group of lawmakers is suing the president, challenging U.S. involvement in Libya. CNN's Brianna Keeler.
The president can commit troops overseas for up to 60 days, and then if he doesn't have authorization, those troops need to be withdrawn within 30 days. Will that deadline is upon us here in just a few days.
The Obama administration believes the law doesn't cover limited military involvement, as is the case in Libya. Embattled Congressman Anthony Weiner has to face his toughest challenge yet, his wife. She returned from an overseas work trip today. The New York congressman has said he wouldn't make a decision regarding his career until speaking with her face to face. The most trusted name in news. This is CNN Radio.
Arizona News Radio, 20% containment on the Wallo fire as new Trioso residents go back home. Still concerns about some other unburned areas as well.
There's probably 700 or 800 firefighters operating in just this area. So that one fire, that one area in and of itself is as complex as a lot of regular Type 1 incidents.
The Monument Fire near Sierra Vista, 5,200 acres, 10% contained, and they don't want to see a flare-up like yesterday.
The winds are predicted to be at 25 miles an hour. The conditions are very, very dry.
A lot of blame shifted at a House hearing on a federal firearms bust that allowed weapons to get into the hands of Mexican drug cartels.
When I voiced surprise and concern with this tactic, my concerns were dismissed.
One of those weapons used in a shootout that killed Agent Brian Terry. And lawyers discussing jury instructions, closing arguments in the Camp Verde trial of motivational speaker James Ray.
There may be speech here. And you just can't use that as a reason to be prejudiced or biased.
George Taylor, Arizona News.
And this KFNX traffic report is brought to you by your Arizona Farmers Insurance Agents. You're going to find some slow traffic on the Maricopa heading eastbound between 24th Street and the Superstition. The Loop 101 westbound has some brake lights showing between 17th and 67th Avenue, and there is an accident on the right shoulder eastbound of the 10 right before 7th Street. Are you saving as much as you could? See how your knowledgeable local farmer's agent can save you money. Call Brent Brinson at 480-897-1221 today. We are insurance. We are farmers.
Jim Howell for the KFNX Weather Center. Believe it or not, we're going to have a gradual cool down into the weekend. We'll still remain above the century mark by Friday, 103. And into our weekend, Sunday afternoon, we're back to 100. Jim Howell, KFNX Newstalk Radio, 1100.
And currently at our downtown studios, we're sitting at 107 degrees. Next news in 30 minutes or when it breaks here on KFNX News Talk Radio, 1100.
Attention women business owners looking for strategies to grow your business and build professional relationships with other successful women? Then we invite you to join the Phoenix chapter of the National Association of Women Business Owners. NABO is one of the five most influential organizations in the Valley, according to the Business Journal. We offer many networking opportunities, business education seminars, and a nationally recognized mentoring program. For more info, go to nawbophx.org or call 602-772-4985. That's 602-772-4985.
He's the voice of choice. Lou Dobbs leads the independent nation. Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. Only on KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. And streaming live at 1100KFNX.com.
Hey, this is Sully from The Big Biz Show. Join me live Monday on KFNX AM 1100 at 12 p.m. If you want to hear about business in an entertaining way, check us out on The Big Biz Show. BigBizShow.com is our website. Remember, Monday, 12 p.m. right here, KFNX AM 1100.
My clients have personally called to thank me because they haven't lost any money in their annuities. In fact, many are earning nice returns right now. Hi, this is Steve Lance, author of Annuities, a 21st Century Pension Plan. If you're tired of stock market losses in your 401k or your investment accounts, my book is a roadmap on how to immediately stop the losses and quickly recover so you can enjoy the retirement you've planned for. You deserve some good news, so call me at 800-445-2516, 800-445-2516, or go to AskMrAnnuity.com and get your roadmap to retirement.
New Grand Prix Auto Body reminds listeners one of the largest threats to children today is automobile accidents. Slow down near parks, playgrounds, and other residential areas. Give our children a break by remembering when a car hits a car, that's an accident. But when a car hits a child, that's a tragedy. This reminder from New Grand Prix Auto Body, located at 3825 West Indian School Road in Phoenix, and a new location at 507 East Van Buren in Avondale. Call 602-272-3517 or visit them online at thenewgrandprix.com for more info.
This is Dennis Wolacek. We're back with Judge Ann Timmer, Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, with us here talking about the intricacies of the Court of Appeals. And for the next approximate half hour, we're also going to be talking about the probate system in Arizona. In fact, let's start talking about the probate system, if you don't mind, Judge. You were appointed, as I said at the beginning of the show, as the chairman of a special probate commission by the Supreme Court Chief Justice. What, tell our listeners about what the purpose of that commission is, why it was formed, and what you've been doing on that, if you would.
Sure. Well, it's the name of it, it's a long name, it's the Committee on Improving Judicial Oversight and Processing of Probate Court Matters. So I had to sit here and read that myself because I can't remember it. And it was formed approximately last April or May by the Chief Justice. She asked if I would head it up, having no particular probate experience in my life except for we do hear appeals of probate matters. But a couple reasons of why it was formed and why I was asked, I think. There have been a lot of criticism in the papers and in other elsewhere in the media about how the probate system has run, particularly with guardianships and conservatorships. And just to keep people straight, guardianships are you'll have a guardian of a ward, meaning it's a person that you make kind of those decisions. Where will this person live, for example? Conservatorship is someone who has power over their money and so what will be paid. So those are the two differences that are. So probate will have, when you say probate, you're talking about guardianships for minors and adults, conservatorships for minors and adults. You have trusts, and then you have what most of us think of, which are decedent's estates when somebody dies and they have a will or don't have a will, what happens to their assets. And in Arizona, probate court's also mental health commitments, oddly enough, but it's that's not what our committee was formed to oversee. The mission we were given was to look at the existing policies, rules, statutes, training regimens, anything having to do with court oversight, to see if there are any flaws, see if there are any loopholes. It's been a while since it's been looked at, with the criticism in the paper and stuff, it brought the Chief Justice's attention to it, and which I admire her for turning quickly to it, and to say, well, take a look, not at any particular case, because we weren't charged with the to investigate any particular case, and frankly, they didn't give us any resources to do that, so we couldn't do it. But what we did do is set up a website and invited any which way we could public comment and ask for those kind of anecdotal concerns. And we got a lot of people who would come to our meetings or they would submit written responses. So as a result of that, we made a number of recommendations to the what's called the Arizona Judicial Council, who advises the Supreme Court, back in October for legislative changes. And some were adopted, and we ended up working with members of the legislature to pass bills. And so they did. They've passed
three bills. Competing bills, as I understand it. Am I correct in that?
Well, it started out that way. The stuff started to go through the Senate and some through the House, and they overlapped. In some respects, they addressed the same subject matter. So it was fascinating for me because I never really dealt with this kind of thing before. But the two sponsors of the bill, Representative David Smith,
right,
and Senator
Adam Driggs. We've actually had him on the show.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, they worked well with us and with each other and ended up putting most of the changes into the Senate bill. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they both had a hand in it and worked with members of the executive
branch. So they actually cooperated down there.
Oh, yeah,
there.
They did.
That's great
and
to
with
hear.
And with the judiciary.
Yeah.
And with interest groups, listening to families that had concerns about how probate is managed in Arizona, and listened to fiduciaries, professional and lay fiduciaries.
Now, let me interrupt you for a second. The problem was that there was a lot of publicity. In fact, your sister, Lori Roberts, mm-hmm. many people may not know that, but Lori Roberts is your sister, wrote a lot of these articles for the Republic that exposed a lot of the problems, frankly, that occurred in the system. Overcharging, overbilling by, I guess, fiduciaries, and who else?
Lawyers.
Lawyers, yeah.
Well, those are the allegations, at least.
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, the allegations were that there was a lot of rampant overspending and lack of a lot of oversight, quite frankly,
right,
was the allegation. And I know, having read some of those articles, that they focused on a couple of people. There was an elderly lady that apparently was fleeced out of, allegedly millions of dollars on fees. And then there was the Walt Disney heir, Lund, that there was a lot of publicity to. And basically, that was the allegation, right, that the system was sort of out of control. So what concrete things are being put into place now that you can tell us about to try to resolve some of those allegations? Let's just put it that way, because nothing's been proven on any of it, right?
Nothing's what? I'm sorry.
Nothing's been proven on any of those.
Oh, right. Well, I think those cases are going through the natural course of the
which I'm not going to ask you
the courts and to the appeals and that kind of thing.
Right.
But yeah, we were looking things more to, okay, where are there some loopholes or some hidden holes, that kind of thing, and how the system's set up. So just today, as a matter of fact, we issued our final report, and then we disband after next week. I present it to the Judicial Council, and the Supreme Court can then decide what they want to do with the recommendations. So we've made, in an interim report, we made 12 recommendations, and today we've made 32 additional recommendations for rule changes and some other things. That and here's that they fall into basically three categories.
Yeah.
One which you didn't mention, which is another reason for this committee, and I think the reason that I was asked to chair it, is the transition of minors from minors who need guardianships to adulthood and conservatorships. And the reason is because my middle child is in need of assistance. She's deaf and she's also severely autistic. And when she turned 18, my husband and I had to go through that process ourselves. So here we are now, a user of going through and getting her a guardian appointed. And it just seemed like a ridiculously, needlessly complex system.
It is a complex system. I don't really understand
after
34 years of practice.
It seemed, some parts, it just seemed difficult. It seemed confusing. And a big problem that I recognized was that we naturally thought, all right, well, we'll start the process when she's 17, so you'll have a seamless transition when she turns 18. So we do everything. You have to get an investigator, an attorney appointed. You jump through a lot of hoops, which is fine, because you have to make sure people, you know, are going to take care of these children as adults. And then we go to court, and the judge says, well, I don't have jurisdiction. I have no authority. She's still 17. And so come back, start over at 18. I said, well, wait a minute. Then you'd have a six-month gap. And so in my case, I ended up asking, we asked the judge, well, can't you just take under advisement and rule on her 18th birthday? And he did. But it struck me that, well, you shouldn't have to have two law degrees to, you know, have the system work. So I mentioned it to the Chief Justice that you really need to do something and make some of these changes or ask the legislature to make some changes. So that's, I think that's why I was asked to chair this. That was part of what we did, and frankly, that's the easy part. And that's been corrected. The new laws, you can start when the child is 17 years and 6 months. It can shortcut some of these psychological and physical examinations that, instead of repeating it, if you already have it in place, which a lot of kids do.
Well, what about the I'm glad you mentioned that. What about the cost of this process for ordinary people?
Well, it's still costly, although you go on the financial wherewithal of the child, not the parents. So, although they don't tell you that, so
in your case, for example, you had to hire an attorney, and
they appointed an attorney.
Oh, they did
her.
Appoint.
Yeah,
her.
They appointed an attorney for her, and there are other states that realize that with some severely disabled children who obviously are going to need a guardian as an adult and who have a well documented history, because most do if you're in the system of issues, that it seems almost it's just unnecessary to appoint the attorney. It's an unnecessary expenditure of resources. So some states forego a lot of that and let the judge just interviews the child to make sure that they couldn't understand their legal rights, for example. Like my daughter couldn't understand when the lawyer tried to explain her legal rights, that kind of thing.
Sure.
So that's one thing we took care of. The other two big features that people are more interested in probably are that we covered is improving judicial oversight and then setting some guidelines on fees that can be charged by both fiduciaries and by attorneys. So some of the concrete recommendations we made, I'll give you an example. A problem with oversight that we found was that once a guardian or a conservator, and I'll just call them a fiduciary because that's what they are, special, that fiduciary just means they have a special obligation of trust and responsibility for people.
We have to pick that up. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we have to pick that up after the break. For these brief messages, hopefully, and we'll pick that right up.
Since 1991, the law offices of Willinchek & Bartness have provided quality business litigation service that you'd find at a big firm with small firm atmosphere. Willinchek & Bartness specialize in cases of breach of contract, real estate litigation, construction defect, business fraud, and breach of fiduciary duty. For professional yet very personal legal representation, call Willinchek & Bartness today at 602-606-2810, 602-606-2810.
I'm here to tell you this. If Republicans take that lesson from the defeat in New York 26, they might as well kiss their majority in the House of Representatives goodbye and kiss any hope of retaking the Senate goodbye. Republicans win when Republicans are forceful, on point, persuasive, and talk about these core, these central issues of liberty and American exceptionalism.
Laura Ingraham, mornings at 6 on KFNX.
Afraid of high car repair bills? Would a $4,500 engine replacement hurt your savings?
Just a little?
Cover America Auto wants to give you a free quote on peace of mind protection. If your car breaks down, we'll pay the repair shop on covered repairs directly. No waiting for reimbursement. No hassle. If you're driving without coverage or if your warranty is about to expire, call us. You can trust you will be protected. Our claims department has an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau with 50 years of dependability.
I just brought my car in, had the transmission replaced, and they paid the bill.
Plus, our direct-to-the-public rates can save you thousands off of what dealers may charge. Call for your free, no-obligation quote now at 800-681-1793, 800-681-1793. 24-hour roadside assistance and rental car is included on most plans. Don't wait. Call for your free quote now, 800-681-1793, 800-681-1793.
This is Dennis Wolacek, and we're back on Legalese every Wednesday from 4 to 5. And with us today has been and will be for the next few minutes, Judge Ann Timmer from the Arizona Court of Appeals, Chief Judge of the Arizona Court of Appeals. And we're talking right now with the judge about the probate system, which she is chairing a committee on at the request of the Supreme Court. And, Judge, maybe you can describe for our listeners, sort of in summary perhaps, what the legislature has now done in response to this whole probate issue, and then what your commission is now doing in terms of perhaps a summary of the most important aspects of your report.
Sure. I'll start with the legislature. Yeah. And we gave them some recommendations that we were going to put, could have been rule or law, and some they adopted and some they didn't, some they put in the law, some we've recommended now for rule. For example, one of the big problems that we found was that people complained about is that when you do have a fiduciary who, again, would be their guardian or conservator, who doesn't get along with the protected person or the ward, I'll just call them both the protected person in need, or their family, who's a lot of times are very
involved. Elderly person, for example.
Right, for an elderly person, and then they have family members, and sometimes they just don't get along, and it creates problems. Problem is that under our system, that a conservator can only be removed, meaning almost, you know, fired, and then that's what's called a reportable event. They have to report that to the Supreme Court, who oversees their license. So you can imagine that people, they don't want to be removed, so they're going to fight against it. And when you fight against it and they're entitled to their own lawyer, that lawyer is paid out of the estate of the protected person. And so pretty quickly, those fees can escalate. And that's a problem. So one thing the legislature did on our recommendation was to, now the law says, and it'll be effective January 1, that says that the judge now has the authority to substitute, not remove, but substitute a new person for a conservator or guardian. And you don't have to find some wrongdoing on behalf of the conservator. And the idea is just like a divorce. Sometimes you just don't get along. So
they never had that power in the past.
No, they had to find some kind of wrongdoing. And so that was a real problem. So
that's a big step.
So that's an example. You also have a number of family members that would complain, and the wards complain, we don't get information about our own money. And so that the legislature's passed a law now, again, effective January 1, that if they ask, you have to hand it over.
Okay.
You have to give them that information. So the whole upshot of what the legislature
can relatives ask for that? Because sometimes the protected person isn't capable of it.
If there's somebody that's it's called an interested person, in other words, they'd be entitled to notice of what's going on in the conservatorship or the guardianship, yes, they can ask, although you can't constantly bug them about it, so once every 30 days.
Now, and I don't want to get too much into the specifics of it for reasons that are obvious, but in the Disney situation, I'll say, which is just an example of a situation I'm thinking of, really, where you have someone who has money, they're a protected person, and then you have claims of the conservator or whatever is misusing their funds, and they're not aware of it. They have no clue what is happening with the funds. The judge has an independent duty in that scenario to review, obviously, how the money's being spent, but a lot of times the allegation is the judges really don't look at that carefully. Is that the problem?
Well, again, I can't speak to that case, especially since it's pending in my court. But yes, that's a problem that we identified, and that was probably one of the largest problems in my personal view, is that the way it works is that once the fiduciary is appointed by the court, then the investigator has already gone out there, everybody is done, and you're just left with the protected person and the conservator, for example. The conservator then is able to, unless they've been restricted, can spend the money of as that person sees fit, of the protected person. After a year, then the conservator has to file an account with the court. The court will probably see it, 3 months later by the time it hits there.
By that time,
the money has been spent. Yeah. And I think a lot of it, I think, is just human nature, that once the money is spent, to order somebody to reimburse it, you're basically accusing them of wrongdoing.
Yeah.
So it's different than pre-approving it. So that's a problem. You also have the problem that there's really no one on the other side to raise objections. And a number of these judicial officers, don't have a background in being a fiduciary. They might have an idea of what an attorney should spend and an idea of, how much time should it take, what should the rate be, but they haven't been a fiduciary. So they don't know how many times should the person have gone out on a shopping trip, for example, in a month. There's no real feel for that. So I think that it's just you take those things together, and there's a real possibility then it's not getting the kind of scrutiny if you just hand a bunch of bills paid.
And who actually advocates for the protected person in that scenario?
Well, the protected person is assigned from the get-go his or her own attorney. There's some confusion we found among judicial officers. Well, how long does that appointment last? Should it last a lifetime, or does it expire after the appointment? Who's there to really look at the bills? Most of the time, the attorneys stay on, but there's a disincentive that they had for
fighting
the bills.
And in a Disney's general situation where you have somebody who has money, does the money for that lawyer come from the protected person's estate?
Yes. Money comes from the – if somebody has money, the money will come from the person's estate as well as the money for the fiduciary and the money for the fiduciary's attorney.
So you can see how this could be racked up.
Oh, yeah. And you can get a guardian ad litem who is somebody – who also comes from the estate's money. So automatically get four people billing off of this estate,
right.
and no one's looking at it for it until a year after. And that's a problem. So this is what we're recommending. We're recommending a change and try to get more transparency and disclosure right up front. So when someone files a petition for guardianship or conservatorship, just take the money one, they will. What we're recommending is that they need to also file with it a schedule that shows, here's what we estimate will be spent. You can't know everything, obviously. You don't have a lot of the information.
But some kind of budget.
But something right from the get-go. And what we think that will do is it'll alert family members who might a year later say, gee, had I known it cost that much, I just would have done it myself. I wouldn't have gotten a fiduciary.
Right.
But they don't know. I mean, who would once you've gone through this? So this will get people to have disputes. Or remember, most fiduciaries are actually not professionals. They're family members. But you can have siblings fight later about decisions that were made. So if you have, for example, a brother who says, well, I plan to put my grandmother in the Cadillac of nursing homes. You might have a sister who says, well, wait a minute, you're spending my inheritance.
I've seen that.
I don't want her. She doesn't need to go there. Well, if you reveal that up front with the petition, the judge has the ability then to resolve that dispute before it just goes crazy in the first year or so and litigation and such. So we recommend estimates, and then the judge will have the ability, under the rules we're proposing, to order after they're appointed. They have 90 days to do what's called an inventory, so they actually go through and see what this person has and what their needs will be. We're recommending the judge have the authority then to require a budget, which will be presumptively required and all, which now will be more detailed, and that you have to then follow the budget with some leeway, like $2,000 or 10%. If you're going to pass that, you need to come back and inform everybody that, gee, now we realize maybe grandmother had a stroke and needs more care. So, change the circumstance. The idea is that before all the money is spent, that people are kept informed, the court's kept informed, and can resolve disputes before all the money is spent.
All right. In the few minutes we have left, if you can try to summarize for us what the legislative enactment now is going to do, as far as you're concerned, the biggest thing it's going to do to change the way business has been done as usual. And you've already told us a little bit about what your recommendations are to the Supreme Court with regard to rule changes and so forth, right, in terms of how the system operates. Try to explain for us, so we understand, how the legislative enactment dovetails with what you're doing in terms of the court.
Well, as I say, there's so many different aspects of it. I'll just pick on one that's a real concern to most people, which are fees, the amount of fees. And in order for a judge to act, you obviously have to have authority. A lot of people don't forget that you can't just do what you want. You're not the king of the world. You have to have authority. So where do we get that authority? From court rules or from the law, from legislation? The legislation here, there was never a specific what we call fee shifting or ability for the court to award fees or order somebody to reimburse fees that have acted unreasonably in some kind of litigation, like the brother-sister type situation, for example, or a fiduciary or another lawyer, that if they act unreasonable, the court could have the ability to say, hey, you need to pay this back to the estate. Now the legislature in the bill that just passed gives the court that authority. So that's one aspect of it. The
other,
on the rule side, there's the ability of the court then to have guidelines of, well, what is a reasonable fee for a fiduciary for an attorney, and so that the courts who might not have a background in this can at least have guidelines that everybody can operate off of, have a general expectation, and then if you're going to vary from that, then you have to justify it. So it keeps things more consistent, more predictable. The entire approach that we took is a more holistic one to provide transparency and oversight to the system for the protection of the best interest.
Do you think in the limited time you've had to look into this, that between the legislative changes and the court changes that you're proposing, that you really have solved this problem that we've discussed earlier, all the different issues related to the problem, or is this just a start?
I think it's just the start. I think you can't say solve because, frankly, a lot – and by the way, our problems in Arizona are mirrored throughout the U.S. This is an issue in almost every state. And so we are at the forefront of it, and we've been working with the National Center for State Courts. In fact, we've got some funding – the Supreme Court got some funding to help us with implementing some of this with training and et cetera. But we've had to, frankly, make up – we've made stuff up. We've made something brand new that hasn't been tested anywhere. So – one of the strong warnings that we're giving as a committee to the Supreme Court is you need to keep monitoring, looking at this, making adjustments as necessary to,
so it's a process.
To solve it. It's a process.
This is absolutely a good start.
Yes.
All right. Well, you know what? We have about a minute left. I want to thank you very much for being on the show. It's rare that a judge will take the time to do this, and I think it's been of great help to our listeners. Any final comments you have about anything that's going on at the court right now?
Electronic. That's what we're transitioning into that world. So yeah. For all you lawyers out there practicing in our court, please be patient with us.
Yeah, and then you've got a new judge possibly coming in, too,
we
right?
We do. We're looking for a judge from any place in our division outside of Maricopa County.
Any place other than Maricopa County.
Any place other than Maricopa.
So if you want to become an appellate court judge and you live here, you got to move elsewhere.
Is that right?
All right. Well, thanks for having taking the time. We're just thrilled you were here. And we will talk to you, all of our listeners, next week, Wednesday from 4 to 5, and take care.
Guys, I want to talk to you about engagement rings. Why is it that most of you are on the I Wanted To program? Last week, my fiancé said he wanted to clean the dishes for me, but instead left them in the sink the entire week while I was out of town. Or last year, when he wanted to take me to my favorite restaurant for Valentine's Day, but didn't, as we ended up eating meatloaf at his mother's house. So when he told my sister he wanted to buy me an engagement ring, she told him he better go to London Gold unless he wanted to hear the word no. Guys, this is great advice, as we don't want some overpriced run-of-the-mill ring from a corporate jewelry chain store. We want an original, unique, one-of-a-kind ring. And London Gold is the only place in the valley where you're going to find that. So stop wanting to get the perfect ring and do it today at London Gold. Now with 3 valley locations, Scottsdale, Chandler, and Glendale.
You're listening to Arizona's News Talk Leader, KFNX 1100. Cave Creek, Phoenix, a division of Premier Radio Stations, LLC.